You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. I'm your host, Erin O'Sullivan. Today we are talking to Andy Alexis Baker about a new book that he has co-edited with Trip York. The book is called A Faith Embracing All Creatures, Addressing Commonly Asked Questions About Christian Care for Animals. For this interview, we're going to start with a bit of background information on Andy and then ask him to give us a general overview of the book and why he thought there was a need for such a book. Then we're going to dig into some of the nitty-gritty of the book, the actual questions surrounding where animals, animal rights, and veganism and vegetarianism fit into Christianity. It's really quite interesting stuff, even if you're not a Christian, so please stand by. It's going to be a neat show. So away we go. Andy, welcome to Animal Voices.
Hey, thank you, Erin. It's great to be here.
Now, before we get started, I do have to note that while I was raised a sort of pseudo-Catholic in the going to church on Christmas and Easter and the like kind of way, my understanding of Christianity is pretty rudimentary. So I've got to warn you that the level of debate you're going to get out of me might not be uber sophisticated, but I will try. So bear with me. Okay, so the first thing that I want to ask is just for you to tell us a little bit about yourself. So all the best, who's, whys, what's, when's, and where's of your history, and maybe a bit of commentary, of course, on how you became interested in animal issues.
Well, I'm a Mennonite, and I'm currently a PhD candidate at Marquette University studying in systematic theology. And I became interested in animal issues about 12 or 13 years ago. I had became a pacifist as a Christian and read a few articles by a theologian named Stanley Hauerwas, who argued that we should think about animals. And I had never thought about this issue much. And I found it really compelling. He argued that it's a kind of natural extension of our, you know, nonviolence as Christians to think about non-human animals. And I found that to be very compelling. And for many years, I didn't do much more with it except for stop eating animals. I became a vegan about 4 to 5 years ago after watching a video called The Peaceable Kingdom put out by Farm Sanctuary, I believe. And that really kind of set me on a course to be more active about the issue. And that, I suppose, is where this book comes out of, that commitment to trying to be more vocal about the issue and trying to be more proactive in not just making it a private, personal choice that I made, but more of an issue of trying to help.
Is the religion that you follow now in your adult life the same as the one that you grew up with as a child and that your family practices? And if so, how did they react to your new views on animal issues?
I didn't grow up in a church, really. The most I ever did as a kid for church was my parents would drop me off at Sunday school, and I got kicked out of Sunday school for being bad. So I became a Christian later in life, in my early 20s, and my parents became Christians too later, and they're more of a, how should you say, they're more evangelical, more conservative, and so their reaction to animal issues is not much different than it was probably before, except they add, you know, stuff about God to it, mm-hmm. You know. They would always have thought that humans are superior and, you know, animals are here for us to eat, but now they just add the theology to it, I suppose.
Can you now, I guess, give us a brief overview of the book? So what it's about and why you decided that the world needed this book?
Well, the book is about answering common questions any Christian will get when they say, I'm a vegetarian or I'm a vegan or even I care about animals at all. So typically, someone will say, well, didn't Jesus eat fish? Or, you know, what about the Passover? Jesus ate lamb, obviously. Or they'll say something about dominion. You know, humans have dominion over creatures, which means we can eat them. Or then there's any number of issues that then come up just by simply stating that I don't eat animals or simply sitting at a table and not eating and people notice. So the questions in the book are some of the most common questions. They're not all of them, but they're very common. And I've read most of the literature I can find on Christianity and animals, as far as books and articles. And I couldn't find a single source. It just goes through those questions carefully and respectfully, taking the question serious and not saying, well, that question really isn't worth answering. You know, you're crazy for asking it or something. We wanted to respect the question, and we wanted to also respect the kind of Christian tradition and not dismiss any part of it without really seriously considering it.
So who would you say the book is for? Is the book more for Christian vegetarians and vegans who are trying to maybe justify their stance to non-vegetarian Christians, or is it for animal rights activists trying to talk to Christians on issues that are maybe important to them?
Well, it could be for both of those audiences. People like myself who had become vegetarian and didn't really know how to answer the questions, hadn't really thought about it, but just had an intuitive sense that this is the right thing, we get asked those questions and it's like, well, I don't know. And that's not very helpful in a discussion with people. So it is for people who are Christian vegetarians or vegans to help them, give them a few more tools to carry on a discussion. But it's also, I think, could be helpful for people who aren't Christian but who have friends, family, who are and who also bring up those objections. Well, you know, of course, the Bible says such and such, you know. And if a person has got a rudimentary understanding of it and goes through the book, they can at least point the person to the book or have a few tools at their disposal that are respectful of the person, where the person is coming from, but also give a different interpretation and a different view of that. So it could be helpful.
So this is an edited book. It's not just by you and Tripp, but it's actually a collection of chapters from a bunch of different scholars. And I was actually kind of surprised to see some of the ones I'm familiar with, but never maybe would have expected to see in a book about Christianity. For example, Mark Beckoff, who wrote the foreword, and then Carol Adams, who I associate with the sexual politics of meat and who I sort of mentally classify as a feminist. But then I actually asked my partner, Neil, who is one of those people that knows absolutely everything somehow. And he was like, oh, yeah, she's actually a doctor of divinity. So who knew? But I guess my question for you is, why did you decide to go with an edited book format rather than just writing the book yourself? And how did you go about selecting the people to be involved in the book?
Well, we went with a edited collection because we put it as part of a series that is called the Peaceable Kingdom series, where this is what we're doing. And when I first thought of the idea, I simply don't have the answers to some of these questions. So I'm like, well, who might be willing to think about it? And so I just started contacting people who I had read or who I knew and asked them if they'd be willing to write. And thankfully, most of the people I asked were quite willing to, you know, write for somebody who just kind of cold called them. I'm lucky I've edited some other books, so they trusted me a little. Now, Mark Beckoff, he's not a Christian. We asked him to do the foreword because reading his work, I felt like he would be somebody who could come as a non-Christian and look at this book and say, you know, would this be helpful? And he's had such a big impact on me and how I view animals that I was just really happy that he would be involved at all in something like this. As far as how I chose other authors, well, we tried to give a big mix. So some of the biggest names in animals and theology are in here. So Carol Adams, you know, she's a Christian. We have Stephen Clark, a philosopher out of England. David Clough, Brian McLaren, he's the only non-vegetarian writing. But he had publicly stated on his website that he's moving in that direction. So we thought, well, let's get him to read this book and push him further in that direction. And he, indeed, that's what's happening with him. So we tried to get a mix of popular people who people already know and have written on this stuff before and people who aren't. And we also tried very hard to make the gender balance balanced. Most books on Christianity and animals have three, maybe four women authors, and no people of color at all. This book has half women authors and three people of color. So we're really happy to have done that. It's a small step forward in that regard.
Yeah, and you actually have a website for the Peaceable Kingdom series, and there's a site or a page on the authors, so you can kind of go and look at their picture and read a little bit about them, so that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
Okay, so one thing that I also noticed in doing my research for this interview is how really rich the debate is about animal ethics among theologians, clergy, and a lot of also grassroots work on animal issues from a religious perspective. I won't say this came as a complete surprise to me, because I've sort of heard little bits and pieces, but I guess the sort of branch of animal activism I'm involved in, or most of the animal activists I know and people that are interested in this stuff, come at it from a very secular perspective. So can you talk to me a little bit about the thinking in theology around animal ethics? Like, is it a vibrant field? Is it a big field, a small field? Does it interact much with the secular animal ethicists?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. The state of the field, I would say, is it's growing. In the past, say, 4, maybe 5 years, there have been approximately 9 or 10 books on this issue put out by presses ranging from T&T Clark, Cambridge University, to smaller presses like the one we just put out from Whipton Stock. So that's quite a few books on the issue just over the past few years. And a lot of those books are edited. So this book has 18 authors, and other books have similar things. So the debate is going now. One book that recently came out is on Peter Singer and Christian Ethics, put out by a guy who endorsed our book, Charlie Camosi, which is a fascinating issue. I hear he and Peter Singer are planning a conference on the Christianity and animals together.
Really?
At Fordham in New York City. Yeah, it's
that's actually really fascinating, because one of the questions that I have for you that actually doesn't come up until the end of the interview refers to Peter Singer, and it refers to him in the context of the story of the single lost lamb and what that says about utilitarianism from a Christian perspective. But anyway,
yeah.
I'm very interested to read that book. So
yeah, it's called Peter Singer and Christian Ethics or something along those lines. It's Cambridge University. So there's several things happening in the field right now. The first book on systematic theology and animals just came out last year by David Clough, one of the authors in this book, called...
Can I interrupt you for 2 seconds
sure.
to tell me what systematic theology is?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. It's systematic theology is theology that goes through all the different doctrines and tries to connect them together. So there's never been a book that looks at how animals connect to all the different doctrines that Christians think about. So Jesus becoming a human, what does that mean for animals? God being creator, what does that mean for animals? All those kind of doctrines. So there's lots of things like that happening. So it's a vibrant field, but it's still a small field. I don't want to overstate the case here. It's growing, it's vibrant, but it's small. And we want it to be bigger, and there's quite a few of us now doing that. And a lot of the authors in this volume that we just did are their first-time writers on the issue. So my dissertation advisor, Danielle Nussberger, has never written on the issue, and this is kind of her coming out, I guess you'd say. Hey, I'm vegan, you know. Several of the other authors are like that as well. So.
The other part of the question was, do they interact much with the secular ethicists? And I'm not sure if the Peter Singer one is an example, because I actually don't know if he's Christian or not. So,
no, he's not. As far as I've seen from his biography, he studied Christianity and grew up in it, but left it for issues of not thinking we had a good answer for some of these issues. But as far as people interacting with secular stuff, well, as far as people like Mark Beckoff and the scientists or ethologists who are doing the work, a few people have been. Celia Dean Drummond from Notre Dame has done some work and is coming out with a book that will be working with Mark Beckoff's material and some others. David Clough, the person I just mentioned, interacts a bit with some of the ethology in his book on theology. In my dissertation, I'm making a big part of that as interacting with some of these studies on animals and language, for example. So there is some interaction, but a lot of it is, as far as ethology, not as much as could be done. Now, as far as philosophers, so there's a big movement in philosophy on this as well. Derrida, Agamben, and you know, a whole bunch of others are writing on this issue. Not much interaction with those folk at this point. They wouldn't traditionally be considered animal rights activists anyway. But that would be kind of the state of the field as far as the interaction between the two different folks. I think there would be a little bit of suspicion, for example, of Peter Singer and animal rights activists amongst most Christians. So Charlie Camosi's book on Peter Singer Christianity, I think is really groundbreaking in that regard.
Yeah, it should be really interesting. Like animal studies and critical animal studies are, they're a fairly small field too, relatively speaking. So it's interesting to know if they're going to grow together or grow apart or what's going to happen. So we'll have to keep our eye on it.
Well, hopefully we're interacting.
So what's your thesis on?
My thesis is on the incarnation and animals, the incarnation being that God become human, God become a creature is the most wide way to say that. And if we focus our thought on God becoming creature rather than God becoming human, that opens up theology in a whole new way to think about what Christianity means for non-human creation in general, and particularly animals. So I'm dealing with that issue, generally speaking.
Now I'm going to move away from the more general questions about the book and the field of inquiry and into the actual questions addressed in the book. Well, I am actually going to start with one of my own questions, which was raised by the book more than was addressed by the book. So the following is a quote from Mark Beckoff's foreword to the book, and I can't remember if we mentioned this, but Mark Beckoff, who has been on Animal Voices, by the way, so check out his two interviews, but he is a biologist and animal behaviorist. I don't know if I'm using his correct titles. But he says in the introduction to the book, "I hope this book, with its indebtedness to both religious and scientific resources, can help Christians see Christianity anew and help all of us expand our compassion footprint." So my question is about blending religion and science. So how does the book do that? And are Christianity and science okay together, or are they kind of strange bedfellows? Like, I always found the combination kind of strange, given that what I always thought was one of the major precepts of Christianity, or the Catholicism I grew up with anyway, was that God is a mystery. And, you know, to use George Michael's words, you got to have faith.
Yeah. What Mark Beckoff meant by that, I edited the book, but that was one line. I wasn't really sure what he meant, because we didn't really do a lot of interacting with like studies like his own on wild justice or whatever. This is a book answering very specific questions that Christians get, or that, you know, other people might get whenever they raise the issue, that relate to the Bible or theology or Christian history. So I wasn't quite sure what he meant with that. We probably should have edited that little bit out, but I didn't feel like I should edit what he thought, and I didn't ask him. He was in Portugal at the time and very busy. So the book does not interact much with that issue. But in general, I would say that science and Christianity don't have to be at odds. When science distances itself from other kind of, not just Christianity, but any kind of moral framework, you get things like, in my opinion, we get things like the animal testing that happens, where they justify it for other reasons. And I think there needs to be some kind of moral framework or other philosophical or theological framework that happens to help scientists make choices that are not so horrific, at least, you know.
Mm-hmm. One question that occurred to me throughout the book involves how open to interpretation the Bible is. Like, some people say it's more symbolic and open to a wide range of interpretations, while other people, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses tend to take the Bible more literally, or at least there are some groups that are more literalist. Mm-hmm. So, like, if the Bible says the lion will lay down with the lamb, it's actually an actual lion and an actual lamb. So mm-hmm. Would you say that this book is directed more at the literalist interpretations, or is it more at those who read the Bible in purely symbolic terms, or is it somewhere in the middle?
I'd say that it could appeal to both types of people. Now, that passage you mentioned in Isaiah, where the lion lies with the lamb and the wolf with the calf, And then it goes on to talk about how we will study war no more and beat our swords in the plowshares. That, I think, most of us take quite literally, that the world is bent toward a kind of justice and peace, and that what we see now isn't the way things will always be, that there's God will someday end the kind of suffering that's happening and the predation, which means us too. And part of that, how that functions in a Christian's life, how it can function, is to make us not study war anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it turns me pacifist, turns others pacifist. And it, by the same token, I think it should make us vegetarian as well. If it makes us not go to war, well, then it should also make us not war against animals. So there's a certain literalness to that, that kind of interpretation there. But there's also a certain amount of, I guess, symbolic, because you have a chapter in here by Annika Spalde and Pelle Strindland from Sweden, and they take a very non-literal approach to their question, which is on Jesus sending a bunch of demons into a herd of pigs, which can run into a lake. And they talk about how that it's a really coded way of talking about the Roman Empire, which is not really a literal way of interpreting. It is, I guess, if you really look at the Greek, but it's not straightforward. But most of the chapters, I think, don't go that direction as far as Annika and Pelle did, but I appreciated how they interpreted it.
Right. And just for the audience, just to clarify the story, what was going on was there was a man possessed by a demon, and Jesus drew the demon out of the man and put it into a herd of pigs, who then proceeded to run and drown themselves in the sea. And apparently, at least according to the authors, a lot of Christians will use this as evidence that, according to Jesus, one man is worth many pigs, right? And the authors were sort of contesting that interpretation of it by using a bunch of possible alternate interpretations, one of them being that it was an allegory for the Roman Empire, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. There's Greek words in there that are very technical terms that people used for the military back then that we don't get in the English.
Okay, well, wow, time flies. We actually have to stop for a brief station identification, but we are going to be right back with Andy Alexis Baker talking about the new book that he has co-edited with Trip York, called A Faith Embracing All Creatures, Addressing Commonly Asked Questions About Christian Care for Animals. Welcome back to Animal Voices. We are here with Andy Alexis Baker, co-editor of the book A Faith Embracing All Creatures, Addressing Commonly Asked Questions About Christian Care for Animals. So now the big question that everybody is waiting for: was Jesus a vegetarian?
Oh, wow. Yeah. We didn't dress that one. That term is kind of anachronistic to throw back on anybody in that time. I guess that's the first thing I would say, is that vegetarian is a term that, you know, comes up much later. So the reasons people didn't eat animals back then were very, very different sometimes than the ones we have. Platonists didn't eat animals because, for one of the reasons, because they thought the human soul transmigrated into other animals and theirs into ours, and all kinds of issues like that. And so you could be eating your kin or something. Was Jesus a vegetarian, though? If we were to anachronistically put that back in there, I would have to say we don't know.
Like, does the Bible actually at any point say that he ate meat other than fish?
No, it does not. Now, the one place that people will point to besides that passage, and it's only in one passage, it's in Luke 24, where it says that, no other place. The one other place people will point to is the Last Supper, where he goes into an upper room with his disciples and he is eating supposedly a Passover meal. And so people will say, well, a Passover meal, he must have ate lamb because, quote-unquote, Orthodox Jews would have ate lamb. Well, that's not really true. There were a lot of vegetarian Jews, you know, putting the term anachronistically, there were a lot of Jews who did not eat animals back then. One of the groups would have been the Essenes, who didn't eat lamb at Passover. And there were early Christians who interpreted him as not eating lamb at the Passover and rejecting all flesh to eat it. And that interpretation of Jesus carried on for hundreds and hundreds of years after the first century. So my own view of it is that we don't know whether or not he was vegetarian. My own sense is that he was probably, if he did eat anything, he probably ate fish, a specific kind of fish, not just any old fish, right? But probably nothing else.
Yeah, I know that the person writing about the whole Last Supper controversy over whether they ate lamb or not, I've got to side with the book on this one. That is your book. I think if it was there, the Bible would have mentioned it. It tends to be pretty descriptive about these sorts of things. And I have a hard time imagining that they focused on the bread and, you know, just forgot about this great big lamb roast that was sitting in the middle of it. So, but anyway, okay, so the Bible didn't say he ate meat except for maybe one passage somewhere.
Yeah, Luke 24, after the resurrection, he comes and visits his disciples, and he's on the shore while they're out fishing. He had called them away for fishing, and they're back fishing. And he's on the shore, and he cooks some fish for them, and they come in, and he takes a bite as well.
Okay, so the Bible never at any point describes him eating meat other than fish, but there's one instance where it says he ate fish then.
Yes.
Sorry, I know a lot of people will get irritated that I'm saying meat and I'm not including fish, but that's what I meant. So there was an instance of him eating fish. Okay, so we don't know if he ate meat. There seems to be some evidence that he might have eaten fish. So say that he did eat meat. What does that mean for Christians? And this was your chapter, so I can ask you about that, right?
Yeah, I wrote on the question, didn't Jesus eat fish? And I wrote on that because nobody else would touch it. I'm like, oh, no, I wanted like one of you big name people to write on this. Well, I think what it means for us is not much. There are different ways we can look at it. One way would be to say that Jesus ate it, therefore I can too. But Jesus didn't eat fish, quote unquote. Fish is a term that covers so many different creatures, and Jewish law forbade most fish, what we would consider fish, or seafood, for example. Shrimp, catfish, shellfish, oysters, anything without fins or scales were out, for example. So he wouldn't just eat any old creature anyway, if he was following Jewish laws at all. So that argument that Jesus ate it, therefore I can too, well, if you're going to really literally follow that, well, then you can't really eat most of what you find in the grocery store. So there's that. But then there's also issues of what the Bible actually calls Christians to follow. It never says that we should follow Jesus in his dress, or he rode a donkey at one point, that we should ride donkeys, or that we should follow him in diet. It talks about us following his example in terms of love for enemies, love for neighbors, compassion, and being willing to suffer rather than commit violence toward others. Those are the points at which the gospel calls Christians to imitate. And so we have to look at what the industry is doing today with fish, in my opinion, and the Caesar being emptied. This was a revelation to me. I didn't know this as I studied for the writing that chapter, that fishing is one of the worst industries out there. 90% of the fish in the ocean are gone compared to 100 years ago. It's absolutely devastating. And it's not only emptying the oceans of creatures, but also destroying human communities that, you know, maybe depended on fish for some of their survival in North Africa or other places where European and other trawlers are going through and just wiping out the populations of sea creatures. So, you know, if Jesus calls us to compassion and love and these kinds of things, those are the kind of values and practices we have to ask ourselves, I think, you know, would fish eating really be part of that when it destroys not only the creatures in the ocean, but these human communities as well? And I just can't see how it fits.
Mm-hmm. So I guess an analogy would be to say, well, Jesus was eating humanely procured meat, but he wouldn't be very impressed with factory farmed meat, perhaps.
That would be part of it. I mean, if we just go with fish, though, we can't make that argument with lamb at all. But we can say, well, humanely caught fish, if there's such a thing, right? Small operations that aren't destroying the entire bottom of the ocean or whatever. Maybe we can make that analogy with fish based on that one passage. But then we have to also say that, you know, he ate it once. Mm-hmm. We know he ate it once in his entire life, and he calls disciples away from fishing. which is, seems to be significant to me. And they went back to it after he died. So there's some ambiguity about it, in my view.
I have a bit of a question for you, and it has to do with what you were just saying, that Jesus's diet isn't necessarily normative for us, that just because we're called to obey certain teachings, the diet wasn't part of it. And I've got to say, like, I've got a big problem with that maybe. And this is, it's going to take me a little while to get this thought out, so bear with me.
Sure.
So I think the idea of worshiping somebody as a god who you think engaged in a practice that you find cruel is problematic, you know, because actions speak louder than words, I suppose. Like, what the person stands for is implied in their actions. So the idea that Jesus preaches kindness, well, then you have to practice kindness, right? But that raised another big question for me throughout the book, and that's the question of, do Christians believe that Jesus is perfect, or that he's some sort of imperfect man-God hybrid who, like the rest of us, is still learning and growing? And just to illustrate what I mean, and this might be a bad illustration now because you say that Mark Beckoff isn't a Christian, so maybe he interpreted this wrong. But he tells the story where a Gentile woman comes to Jesus asking for a blessing, and he told her he had come for Israel, not dogs. She responded by saying that even dogs get scraps from the table when a person is compassionate, and Jesus liked that answer, blessed her, and expanded his own view as a result of this interaction. So that blew my mind completely on two levels. One, that it was so mean and kind of bigoted. That's totally not the Jesus that I was raised to know, you know? And second, by saying that Jesus expanded his view, it implies that he was not perfect, that he didn't already have the perfect interpretation of God's plan or whatever, but that he, like us, was still kind of learning about what was right and wrong. And if that's the case, then the notion that Jesus's omnivorous diet wasn't normative for his followers seems more palatable because, you know, he was still learning too, and maybe he just hadn't made that connection yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such an interesting story that Mark referenced there. It's fascinating. I think you're kind of right there that I think Jesus was learning. I mean, there are medieval pictures of a little baby Jesus in Mary's womb, and but he's already fully, like, formed. He's just there. So he didn't have any learning at all, according to some of those folk. You know, he came knowing it all. I don't think most Christians today would find that very credible, that, you know, he was a human being. He had to learn. He had to, you know, go through lots of life lessons and things. And so the woman challenged him. You know, he clearly changed his mind there based on her answer to him about, you know, you even treat dogs better than this. And you know, there's not just that story where Jesus was mean. You know, he said some things sometimes that deliberately alienated people, partially because he didn't want, you know, crowds following him for superficial reasons. But sometimes, like this one, where he seems to have, I don't know, not really had as wide a view of non-Jews as he needed to, and I think he expanded that quite significantly during his life. Now, does that mean he's not perfect? No. I think the notion of perfect means that we never learn anything and we never grow, at least as far as our own lives, then I think that he was not perfect. But I don't know that that's what perfect means for us. I think perfect means where we're headed, and it means the kind of general direction our lives are going.
Okay, so vegetarianism aside, how did Jesus generally view animals? And there's some chapters on this about, did Jesus think that people were more important than animals?
Yeah, well, I think the chapter deals with the Bible more generally, and does it say that, I think that's Nikisha's chapter, my wife, she wrote a chapter on, doesn't the Bible say that humans are more important than animals? And her perspective, and I think she's right, is that sometimes it does say that humans are more important than animals. So the Bible doesn't speak with one voice. Sometimes authors will say that. Sometimes authors will say they will equalize humans and animals. We'll have passages where Ecclesiastes, for example, who knows whether the souls of an animal go down to Sheol like those of the humans, you know. So it's kind of an equalizing potential there. And sometimes other creatures are given a kind of superiority to us. Proverbs is full of stories where we're supposed to look at the ants, you sluggard, because you know, they're working and you're sitting around doing nothing or whatever. Or the end of Job, where Job has lamented his losses and God comes along and says, you know, there's all these creatures in the world that I have a relationship with that you know nothing about at all. They have no utility to you, and you couldn't touch them or see them even if you wanted to. So like the big whales in the ocean, you can't even see them usually. Yet I know them. And they come to me, and yet here you are not doing those kind of things. So there's lots of places like that. So it doesn't speak with one voice necessarily. There are different. I think a lot of the authors in this volume take a kind of literal interpretation in many ways, but also see that the Bible isn't a single, like, monolithic thing. There are different authors who speak differently. And Jesus' own view of animals, we see him talking about how God cares for, you know, the sparrows. He even counts the feathers on a sparrow, you know, or whatever, and sees whenever one dies. And so therefore, you know, why are you worried about, you know, your own life? God cares about you as well. Now, some people will take that and say, well, see, God cares about you more than sparrows, but that's not Jesus' point. Mm-hmm. Jesus' point wasn't necessarily that we're better. It's that God cares for all creatures, even these little creatures that you don't really think much of. You know, they're not worth much to you. So I guess that's the way I would answer it as well.
Yeah, I think it's a tough one. Like, I read through those chapters, and there does seem to be some very straightforward things. Like, I think Jesus chastised some people because they were helping a sheep that had been hurt, but they wouldn't help a poor man, and it was on the Sabbath, so they weren't supposed to be working. And Jesus was like, well, how much more valuable is a human being than a sheep? And, you know, to me, that seems pretty straightforward, that it's the same sort of denigration of animals that I might hear from, you know, my uncle or the guy on the street or whatever. But it is so complicated, because at other points you hear other stuff where it's talking about, like you said, about the glory of nature, things that man is completely unaware of and can't even touch. And like, how do you reconcile that with a denigration of animals? So I don't know. I think it's very, very complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, even that passage you mentioned, is he working with their own framework? So, you know, they're calling him on breaking a Sabbath law, and yet they will do the same thing. So he's working within their framework, saying, you know, you'll help your sheep, but you won't help a human. Like, what's going on? You know, like, it doesn't necessarily, I think, have to lead to the moral superiority argument. It's kind of I think it depends on what we come to it with sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard. Like, my intuitive reaction to it is much like the one where he made the comment to the woman about being a dog. You know, it's like that sounded like an insult to me. But anyway.
Yeah.
I think it's clearly one of those cases where people that are intent on believing that animals are worthless will latch onto certain phrases, and people that are intent on believing that God held animals in high esteem will look to other parts of the Bible. That's what it's looking like to me, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's that way with a lot of things. So, but for me, it's more about the trajectory of the entire kind of process. So you come from Genesis, where Carol Adams writes about how God creates everything good and doesn't even pronounce humans good. Doesn't say anything, creates humans in this community already created, and then says it's very good only after the whole process has been done, and humans don't get their own little blessing.
Did the other stuff get its own blessing?
Yeah, every other creature God creates, the fish says they're good, creates birds, they're good, creates land animals, they're good. Humans? Doesn't say that.
No way. What a diss.
No, it doesn't.
I swear, the more I read, the more I read your book, the more I could totally understand how Christians could get really, really into it, trying to interpret the Bible, because there's so many layers. Like, that sounds like a diss to me. But very interesting. Yeah. So
only if it's very good once it's all done, you know. So
Yeah, so you were talking about the trajectory where Carol Adams started again with Dominion. Did you have something else to say about that?
Yeah, so you start there with this creation being good and very good as a whole, to a kind of fall where humans do bad things, we go to war and this stuff, to even Melinda Berry writes about animal sacrifice, and then before that the Noah covenant, where it's all this violence in the world, so God floods the world, and then you know, all the creatures come back off the ark, and God says, I'll make a covenant with every creature that I won't do that again, and allows humans to eat them. Well, Judith Barrett says, well, that wasn't necessarily a blanket statement, like eat them all at all times. Her interpretation is I don't know what to think of this. There weren't any plants. Mm-hmm. He flooded everything. That's pretty literal.
So they were on the proverbial desert island that all of the vegetarians are threatened with, eh?
Yeah. And then, you know, Melinda comes back with this thing saying, well, even animal sacrifice is meant to limit the consumption of creatures. So you can only eat them when you've done these proper things, because you have to give an account. And so it's meant to push them back toward the original vegetarian thing. So there's these things that which is fascinating to me to think about, because I usually don't think of animal sacrifices in any way, shape, or form helpful. And I still don't. It's a disgusting practice. But within the framework they're working in, maybe that was a way of limiting the kind of consumption and the desire for flesh. And wouldn't it be nice if we had a way to do that today?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I don't actually remember that point in the book. But as soon as you mentioned that, the first thing that popped into my mind was the way Native Americans are supposed to, you know, when they kill an animal, giving thanks. And it's that same sort of mentality that supposedly makes them much better stewards of the earth than the modern mentality, where all that ceremony is gone.
Mm-hmm. Where there's no sacredness to creation at all. It's not God's good creation. It's plunderable, you know.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I never would have thought about animal sacrifice in those terms either, but interesting. And I'm actually going to bring up that sacrifice thing again. That was my next question. Like you were talking about, there was this weird trajectory for people that aren't Christian, or even for people who are Christian and just, you know, aren't super familiar with the Bible. So it started off where the world was apparently vegetarian in the Garden of Eden, and then there was the flood, and after the flood, God told Noah he could start eating animals again, and then during, I guess, what the Old Testament, there was a lot of animal sacrifice. But then when Jesus comes along, he actually puts a stop to the animal sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's the interpretation of that? Is that because he's like, whoa, what are you doing? That's horrible. Or is it for another reason? Because there's other interpretations of that in the book.
Well, yeah, that's a complicated issue. I think the first thing to say to it is that it's really interesting that animals can stand in for humans. So the reason that animals are sacrificed at all in the Old Testament is that they are equivalent to humans. That's one of those equivalizing things. Now, I think that there are Old Testament challenges to that idea, too. There are prophets who challenge the whole idea of sacrifice, saying that God requires mercy and compassion, not your animal sacrifices. That's what God wants. So there are passages, even in the Old Testament, that challenge that system. Now, Jesus comes along and is called the Lamb of God, which is a reference to this Passover image. Jesus becomes the Lamb. So Jesus flips it. Now, Jesus is equivalent to the animal, which is another kind of way of equivalizing. And then Jesus goes into the temple toward the end of his life and drives out some of the animals from the temple and tells people to take the doves out of the temple, which is a really interesting thing for him to do as well, because the typical image of Jesus going into the temple at the end of his life is that he goes in, he gets really pissed off, and he just starts beating up people and throwing shit around, and you know, he's just going in a rage. But the fact that he stops and says, take the doves out of here, and doesn't flip over their cages, is really significant. Because if he didn't care about animals, if he thought they were nothing but a, you know, monetary commodity, he just flipped them over. And if he was in a blind rage, he might have too, but he didn't. To me, it's a compassionate act, what he did there. It's a really kind of beautiful act that I would hope nonviolent activists would take to heart, considering animals.
So is that story of Jesus going into the temple the same one where he goes in and kicks the moneylenders out?
Yep, that's the one where he turns over the tables and things. And so you have Jesus then emptying at least part of the sanctuary. Most scholars don't think that he, you know, drove out everything from the temple. It's a big place, right? And he's one person. But he makes a symbolic gesture to end this. And then his own death is interpreted in terms of standing in for the sacrifices that happen and ending it. Like, that's why Christians do not sacrifice animals any longer. It's because Jesus is considered having abolished that.
I'm going to ask you one more question. This is something that's totally foreign to me, but there's a chapter about whether vegetarianism is compatible with Christian hospitality. Mm-hmm. But what is this hospitality issue, and why would being vegetarian ever pose a problem for it?
Yeah, it's a big issue. It's a question that I get a lot, and Laura Hobsgood-Oster, who wrote the chapter, dealt with it in terms of being hospitable to the creatures around us. So it's not hospitable to put them on the table. We need to open up our yards to them and different things. And touched a bit on what happens when we go into somebody else's home and they put food before you.
Okay, so that's what it's all about. I see. So I wasn't sure if it was about the giving of hospitality, like such that if you invite somebody to your house, you have to feed them meat if they're a meat eater, or if it's about what actually is a real sort of relevant issue for any vegetarian, which is what do you do when people offer you meat and they're going to be offended if you say no?
Yeah, it's huge for Christians because it seems like you will be passing some kind of judgment on them right off the bat if you won't eat what they give you.
Right.
And how I usually talk about that is several ways. That first, it's not really hospitable for a host to feed you something that you don't like. So most hosts would not, if a Jewish person or a Muslim come into their home, it's not going to feed them pork. They're not going to say, well, just eat it, you know.
Yeah.
They want to keep them as friends. So vegetarianism is like a kosher diet, you know, in some way. We need to, like kosher life, it needs to be thought of in that way, not as a simple personal choice that people make. The second thing is that when I go somewhere, I usually tell people well in advance, you know, hey, I'm vegan, so I can't eat these certain things. And it gives people an opportunity. It gives them an opportunity to try something new. And I've never found somebody who I've told that to who says, oh, that's such a burden. This was such a pain in the ass. I wish you hadn't come. You know, mm-hmm. They're usually very excited that they've tried something new, and they're excited to, you know, put it before us. So it expands their horizons, and it allows me to have what Christians call a witness. It allows me to then be able to continue witnessing to this issue without it being a point of contention, which I don't want it to be. But if I go to somebody's house and I haven't told them that I'm vegetarian, I usually find something there. Most people don't have only meat on that they're serving. So it is an issue of, you know, respect and wanting to, and there's also an issue of voluntary poverty. So there are Catholic workers and various monastic movements that live in a kind of life where you take what you're given, and they don't really work in the economy. You know, they don't try to make money. They take what's offered to them. And if they were to reject meat, it kind of goes against their values. And I would say the same things to them, that it's still possible to be in those situations and be vegetarian, even though I don't live in it. I still think it would be possible.
Okay, well, we are just about at the end of the interview. Wow, that hour flew by. There's a lot of interesting stuff in that book. So for the last couple of minutes, I want to turn things over to you. So if there's any last words you want to share, maybe tell people how they can get the book or any other recommendations you might have for people who are struggling with marrying vegetarianism and their Christian faith, or maybe with marrying vegetarianism with their parents or significant other's Christian faith.
Sure. Well, first, you can get the book on Amazon or Barnes & Nobles. We have a website called peaceablekingdomseries.com. where you can look at the authors and the table of contents, and we have links to Amazon and places where you can get the book. Words I would say to Christians who are struggling with the issue with family or friends is to read the book, read up on the issue, other books and things, and have an answer when people ask, so that you know what you're talking about. And if people are just in general interested, I think there's this book and other resources out there that can help people give an answer, because I think a majority of Americans are still Christians, so it's a big issue. If we can convince even a small fraction of Christians to be more compassionate toward other creatures, that will make a significant dent in the suffering of animals.
Okay, well, that is it for today. Everybody, if you like this show, it will be up on our website in 2 shakes of a lamb's tail. My puns are so stupid. I'm sorry. It's a disease. I can't help myself. Okay, so yeah, if you like today's show, you might be interested in a couple of interviews we did with Mark Beckoff, for example, one of the book's contributors, so check those out. In fact, check out the whole archive. There's almost 400 shows available now, something for everybody. And if you find one you like, please share it on Facebook. And remember, we've got instant listening now, so for most of the shows anyway, you don't even have to download them anymore. So I just wanted to thank Andy one more time for being on the show. It was really, really interesting.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm a big fan of the show.
Oh, great. That's awesome to hear. Animal Voices is produced from CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines and broadcast since 1996 on CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto's community radio station. You can also listen to Animal Voices on iTunes Radio under the College University category, Star Choice Channel 826, Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946, or online at CIUT.FM. Thank you to the whole Animal Voices team. If you have comments, questions, or show ideas, please email us at animalvoices@gmail.com. I'm Erin O'Sullivan. Thanks for listening.